All right, we're going to begin here on the top of Lamed Amud Aleph, 12 lines down. Tan Rabbanan, Amar Lahem Echad, they have an individual comes, a witness that comes and says, Ani ra'iti avichem, I saw that your father, shehit min ma'ot, b'shida teval migdal. They put away money, he stored money in one of these pieces of furniture. Shida, an armoire or a dresser, a teva, a chest, or migdal is some sort of storeroom or furniture that's used for storage. He says that it belongs to so-and-so, or they belong to Maaser Sheni. In either case, it means that the money doesn't belong to the Yorshim, but either belongs to a third party, or it belongs to Hekdesh, meaning it belongs to Maaser Sheni and needs to be eaten up in Yerushalayim. So now, if that testimony, if money is contained in the house, then he's not believed, or whatever he says has no bearing. Besadeh, if it's said about it in the field, dvarav kayamim, then we believe what he said. Klalo shel davar, principle, the general principle that's being said over here is, kosh biyado litlan, dvarav kayamim. If he has the ability to access the money, then we believe that which he has said. Ein biyado litlan, if he doesn't have the ability to access the money, lo amar klum. Whatever he's saying is meaningless. So the idea being that if the money is out in the field, then he himself can go take the money and give it to the party that it belongs to, or do whatever needs to be done with the money. Since he has access to it, we believe him, because Migo, that he could have just gone and taken the money and done whatever it needs to be done with it. In fact, now he's telling us what needs to be done with the money, we're going to believe him. On the other hand, if the money is in the house where he does not have access to the money, there we're not going to believe him because he doesn't have the ability to access it and do whatever he wants with it. So now he's making a statement, he's an Ede Echad. Is a single aid with regards to monetary matters, and a single aid by monetary matters is not believed. Now, the truth is that Eid Echad is Ne'aman bi'isurim. So that's true with regards to maybe Maaser Sheni. Why don't we say that here he should be believed at least to make it into Maaser Sheni? So the Rishonim have take different approaches over here. Some say that Eid Echad Ne'aman bi'isurim is only the heter. That's only when the person's being matter, the object, that we say Eid Echad Ne'aman bi'isurim. But if Eid Echad's coming to be Oser, then it doesn't necessarily carry that weight. Or the other possibility is that when we say Eid Echad Ne'aman bi'isurim, to make it into something that is isur, that's true for himself. But to make it asur to other people, that's not necessarily true in this case. Here, for him to designate it as Maaser Sheni, he won't necessarily be believed in this instance. So that's why, when it's in the house, he's not believed with regards to this money. Haray, Shera'u et avihen, she'itmin ma'ot b'shita teveo migdal. The children witnessed their father putting away money into one of these pieces of furniture. And the father tells them that the money that he is stowing away in these pieces of furniture either belong to so-and-so, or they are monies of Maaser Sheni that need to be taken up to Yerushalayim. If he is giving over information to them, it's as if he is conveying to them information that they should know, then dvarav kayamim, we believe what he said, and they have to abide by whatever instructions or whatever information that he gave them. Im kima'arim, on the other hand, if he looks like he is doing this to trick them or to be sneaky about it, lo amar klum, then we do not believe what he said, or they don't have to abide by what he said. Rashi over here differentiates between a moser, which is that im nira lahem kimoser dvarav livana be'emet b'lashon tzava'ah. He's commanding his children to deal with the money. He's giving his children instructions about the money. In that case, we believe him, and they have to abide by his instructions. On the other hand, if it's kima'arim, as Rashi says over here, shumitareish lo yitaleim b'chayav, either he's afraid that the kids are going to steal the money while he's still alive, or walk off with the money while he's still alive, so therefore he says it doesn't belong to him, or he doesn't want other people to think that he's wealthy, and that he has money to spend, and therefore he claims that the money belongs to Maaser Sheni or to someone else. If that is his intent, or if that's what they surmise from the way that he's expressing it, then he hasn't said anything. Now, the Gemara here doesn't give any clear delineations as to how to determine whether he is Moser Dvarav or he's Ma'arim, but Rashi gives you a sense of what the intent is, or what you think might think the intent is, and therefore, from that, you would conclude that either he is giving a tzava'ah, he's giving a command to them to do this or follow through on this, or he's simply trying to divert their attention away from the money or convince others that the money is not his. A person knew that his father had left him money, but he had no idea where the money was. And in the middle of his sleep, the Bala Chalom, as Rashi says over here, the Sar HaMimuneh Ala Chalomot, the ministering angel over dreams, comes to him appears to him and says to him, Kach v'kachein, this is the sum of money that it is. B'makom plonihem, this is the location where the money is found. Shel maser shenihem, and the money is monies of maser sheni. So now he gives him a tremendous amount of information. He gives him the location, the amount, and then that they are maser sheni. Sure enough, he goes, and he finds that the money's there, and the amount that the Chabasar Chalom says is exactly the amount that he finds there. The question is, does he have to believe him with regards to the fact that this money is monies of Maaser Sheni? This was an incident that came before the court. It comes to dreams, they don't make it better, they don't make it worse. Meaning that dreams don't have impact on the halachic process. So what's interesting about this is the fact that before we said that an Eid Echad is not believed in this situation, so why would you think that a Chalom should be believed in this situation? The answer might be is because a Chalom has that aspect of Nivu'ah associated with it. We know that the Gemara tells us that a Chalom is 1/60th of Nivu'ah, but more importantly over here, the Chalom is verified by a number of facts. Two out of the three facts in the Chalom are proven true, which is the amount of the money and the location of the money. So there's already a certain amount of verification or veracity given to the dream by the fact that some of the facts are already been checked out and they are true. So maybe we should have to believe the dream fully and that the monies here should be classified as monies of Maaser Sheni. The Gemara concludes, Divrei Chalomot lo malin velo moridin. They don't impact on the halachic process and therefore we're not going to let the dream tell us that these monies are monies of Maaser Sheni if we don't have any other outside corroborating evidence to that fact. That's really based on the Gemara at the end of Brachot that says that there's no dream that doesn't have falsehoods or problems in it, just like there's no grain without bar, without the refuse that's associated with it, so too there's no dream without certain things that are untrue. And that is because a dream requires interpretation, and the interpretation relies on context and information that maybe you don't have all the pieces of the puzzle to. And given that, there are parts of the dream that either may not be true at all, may not need to be understood in their literal sense, but are pointing to something else, or mean something else because we don't have a guide as to the context or the interpretation of the dream. And for that reason, we don't rely on a dream to tell us information that will have normative impact. Right now, the Gemara continues with the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Shnayim Omrim Zakai. Two of the individuals, Paskin Zakai, they say that he's not liable. V'chad Omer Chayav, and one said that he is liable, and we Paskin based on the Rove in that case. Gemara asks, Michtav Heche Katve. How do you write down, how do you document the fact that you have two judges saying not liable, and one judge saying liable, or vice versa? How do you document the situation? Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Zakai. That's all you do. You write that he is not liable. You just write the verdict, really, the conclusion of the case, the outcome that the judges came to, you just write that. That's it. Rish Lakish Amar says, Ploni uploni mizakin. So-and-so said you're not liable. Uploni Amar Chayav. And the other one said you are liable. Rabbi Elazar Amar, Midivrehem Nizdakeh Ploni. From their words or from their deliberations, it came out that this person is not liable. So here you have three different approaches in the Amoraim as to how you document the fact that you have a Beit Din that is paskening based on a Rove. Rabbi Yochanan says that we basically blur the fact that there's a Rove here, and we present a face of unanimity. This is what we spoke about yesterday, that the Beit Din wants the Psak to be accepted as a unanimous decision, and in some senses, it now is attributed to all parties, to all the judges of the Beit Din, even though there was one dissenting judge. That's the view of Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish says we identify the voting judges, and we say, these judges said liable, these judges said not liable, and from that you figure out what the majority is. Rabbi Elazar says, we don't want to have sheker. We don't want people lying. That's Rish Lakish's position as well. We're not going to lie and say, Zakai, that everybody said you weren't liable. That's just not true. So Rabbi Elazar said, opts for the other option, which is to say the truth, which is, these judges said liable or not liable, and the other judge said the opposite. Whereas Rabbi Elazar says, we still want to keep a certain amount of anonymity in the expression of the psak here, but we want to tell the truth that it was not a unanimous decision. And therefore we write, Midivrehem nizdakeh ploni. From the outcome or the conclusion of these judges was that this person is not liable. Now, it seems that Rabbi Elazar would agree with Rabbi Yochanan, if there was unanimity on the Beit Din, then you would write Zakai. in a case where there's not unanimity, then you would use this following formulation, which would then be the truth, which is that the outcome is that you're not liable, but it doesn't present the face of being a unanimous decision. May binayu. What's the nafkamina between the different ways that it could be expressed? Ike binayu, lishlume. Maybe the difference between them has to do with compensation. Ihu manto bahadayu. Does the third judge have to also pay if they paskined incorrectly? So in this case, if they were found to be wrong in the psak, and then they have to compensate the individual who lost money, how many of the judges have to compensate here? So is it all three judges that have to compensate? Or is it only the two judges that made the mistake that need to compensate? The manda amar zakai, according to Rabbi Yochanan, who says that you write a unanimous decision of the Beit Din, mishalim. Then the party who, even though he dissented, is a part of this Beit Din and we're presenting a unanimous face of the Beit Din, he also will be liable for compensating. The manda amar ploni uploni mizakin, uploni mechayev, according to the one, Reish Lakish, who says that we write down the exact decision of the court based on each of the judges, then lo mishalem, he doesn't have to get paid there because we see his dissenting opinion in the judgment. So he didn't make a mistake in his judgment. What's interesting here is that the outcome is that the litigant will actually lose a third of what he's entitled to because the psak of Beit Din moved the entirety of the money, but we're only going to make two out of the three judges liable in this case, and that means that the litigant will suffer a loss of a third. Well, the mandam are zakai mishalim. According to the one who says that, like Rabbi Yochanan, who says that it's unanimous, we present a unanimous decision, is it really true that the third judge has to pay? Lemelahu. Why can't he say to the other two judges, either the ditzai titun, had you listened to me, atunamilo shalmitun, you guys wouldn't have to pay either. So if you had listened to me, you guys wouldn't have to pay. Now that you didn't listen to me, I have to pay. It doesn't make any sense. Elikabe nayud shlume inu manta didei. The nafkamina between them is, do the other two judges have to carry the burden of the third judge who dissented? The manda mar zakai mishalme. According to the one who says that we present the unanimous decision of the Beit Din, then basically they become responsible for the third judge's liability here. Because we take the psak of 2-1 and make it into basically unanimous decision. So those two who are responsible for the unanimous decision now have to split that between them. The three parts of liability will be split between the two judges who voted in that direction. The mandamar ploni uploni mizakin uploni mechayev, according to Reish Lakish, who says we identify the views of the judges, lo mishalme, they're not responsible for the third judge's position, because their position is identified, and his position is also identified. And again here, you would have in this case, a situation in which the individual would lose a third, because only the two judges who are liable would pay, but they would not pay for the third judge's position because his position was against the psak of the Beit Din. And the Gemara again says, "Aman damar zakai mishalme." According to the one who says that, Rabbi Yochanan, who says that we say that the psak Beit Din was zakai, then they have to pay for the other individual's liability. But le mule, why don't they say to him, "Ilav at behadan, had you not joined this Beit Din, lava salik dina mide, it wouldn't have been a psak din in the end." I mean that you need a minimum of three people to have a psak din. So they can say to the other party, if you didn't show up, even though you dissented in your opinion, but had you not showed up at all, or had you said any yudeya, then the psak din would never have come to fruition. Your joining the Beit Din brought the psak din to a fruition. So in some ways, you're responsible as well for the outcome in this case, because without you, there would have been no psak din in this situation. So how could you say that they should be liable for his liability? Ela ika beinayu? The difference between him is mishum lo telech rachil b'amecha. Whether there's a problem of disclosing information about the views of the judges in the case. Yochanan amar zakai. Yochanan says we give one word, and that is the final conclusion, decision of the Beit Din, the psak din, which is zakai. He is not liable. Mishum lo telech rachil. Because in that way you don't identify the judges or the judge's opinion. And so given that, you've now avoided the problem of lo telech rachil b'amecha. So you've accomplished anonymity in the judge's psak, and that's what we want here. Reish Lakish amar, ploni uploni mizakin, uploni mechayev, that these two say that he's not liable, and this one says he is liable. Mishom de mechse kashikra, because overriding or an overarching consideration is we don't want to lie. So it's more important that we tell the truth than we protect the anonymity of the judges. Or another way to say that is, lo telech rachil b'amecha is only valuable when you're telling the truth. But if you're going to lie, then lo telech rachil b'amecha is not a valid reason to skew what the reality or the truth is with regards to the Psak Beit Din over here. Rabbi Elazar, Itle Demar, Vitle Demar. Rabbi Elazar tries to be in basically a compromised position. He wants Lote Lech Rachil Ba'amecha, so he doesn't want to identify the judges. On the other hand, he wants to be sensitive to what Reish Lakish says, which is we don't want to lie in this case. And therefore, Hilche Katve Hochi. This is how they write. Midivrehen Nizdake Ploni. That from their words, from their conclusion, we are making this person not liable, or we deem him to be not liable. So the truth is that Midivrehem is just us speaking about the judges. But the way that would be written in the document is Midivarenu. From our conclusion, then Nizdake Ploni. He was made not liable. So over there, it doesn't indicate that they all necessarily agreed with that opinion. But nevertheless, it does protect the anonymity of the judges. So here you have a three-way machloket as to how to document such a conclusion or such a decision of the Beit Din, the Psak Beit Din. Well, first of all, the Psak follows the position of Rabbi Elazar, which makes a lot of sense. The interesting part about it is the nafka mina of Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha, and many of the Rishonim ask over here, wait a minute, didn't the Mishnah explicitly say that there is a restriction against disclosing the position of the judges in the case? That was the last line in the Mishnah, that then you're in violation of Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha, or Halech Rachil Megaleh Sod. The Mishnah brought both of those psukim to say that a judge may not say to the litigant, listen, I voted in your favor, but what can I do that the other judges overwhelmed me, or they were the majority, and therefore you're considered to be liable. So that's what the Mishnah said. So how can Reish Lakish all of a sudden come over here and say, oh, don't worry about Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha, it's Sheker. But the Mishnah said it, and the Mishnah didn't worry about Sheker. So how does Reish Lakish argue on the Mishnah? So here the Rishonim give different answers as how to deal with Reish Lakish versus the Mishnah. Some of them see a very, very nuanced or fine difference between them, which is that there's a difference between the Beit Din giving out the information and an individual giving out the information. An individual judge may not disclose that information. The Beit Din in their psak can disclose that information. So the truth is that there may not be very much time between those two positions, but the judge cannot preemptively give out that information. He has to wait for the psak Beit Din to come out and disclose that information. That might be a fine difference between them. And again, that's really, really on a thin line, the difference in timing between those two items. So the Ran explains, you could go further to say that even after the Psak Beit Din is out there, that the individual judge may not approach the litigant and tell him, listen, I was in your favor. Even though that information is now known because of the Psak Beit Din that is public, nevertheless, he can't go out and try to curry favor or flatter the litigant by saying that I really didn't want you to be liable in this case. So that might be the restriction, independent of whether the information is known or not known. The others describe here a difference between the Mishnah and here, because this part of the sugya begins, Michtach Hevi Kotve. How do you write down such a decision of the Beit Din, such a Psak Din of the Beit Din? So that might be the difference between what we see in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is when the conclusion or the decision of the Beit Din is read out orally to the litigants that are there. What we're speaking about in the Gemara over here is the documentation of that decision. What we learn from this is that not every decision is subject to being written down or publicly given out as a written conclusion. That is, either there's some that suggest that if the Balei Dinim, the litigants, ask for it to be documented, then it will be documented and given to them. Otherwise, it'll just remain as a Psak Beit Din, an oral Psak Beit Din, but not given out to the other parties to read. Obviously, they'll document it in Beit Din and have the stenographers writing it in Beit Din, but they will not hand out a written document as to the conclusion or the decision of the Beit Din. Others suggest that we only write it down when another Beit Din needs to see the decision, or that the litigants are taking it to another Beit Din in order to deal with the issue. So that's when you have to write it down. Still others suggest that the writing of the documentation is only given to the defendant here. The defendant gets the information that says that he is not liable, and he has the documentation of the judges. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the other party knows that. The claimant knows that information, and that information is disclosed to the claimant. Therefore, if the judge discloses it, that's where there's a problem. So the Rishonim tried to distinguish between our case over here, where Reish Lakish says it's a problem to lie, and we don't worry about Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha, versus the Mishnah, where we do worry about Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha. All right, now, Gamru et ha-davar hayu machnisim. So at the end of the Mishnah, it says that after they finish the deliberations, they bring them in. So there's a pronoun that's used there. The question is, who does the pronoun reference to? That machnisin otan. You bring them. Who are the them there? Laman. Who is it? Ilema lebali dinin. If you say they bring in the litigants, hatam kaime. They were still there. The litigants were never taken out of the room. They never left. Now that's interesting because that presents the same problem that we just saw before, which is if the litigants are present during the deliberations, then the litigants know what the conclusion of the Beit Din was, or they know who was leaning in which side. So that makes it interesting because then why do we worry about disclosing that information? So the Ran explains, even if they keep the litigants in the room, that doesn't mean that they deliberate out loud and that the litigants are privy to the discussions of the Dayanim. This might be that they can stay in the room. Doesn't mean necessarily that they hear the deliberations. Ella, the Gemara says it's not about the litigants, but rather the Edim, that we bring the Edim back in. Because the Edim were taken out for the Yum, and then we bring them back in the end to be there together to testify. Come on, who is that like? The Lok Rabbi Natan. This is not like Rabbi Natan. And now the next part of the Gemara is a sequence in the Gemara that we saw twice in Baba Batra, a two series of machlokot that come out of a braita, the Tanya. The olam ein edutan mitzterefet ad shiru shnehem keachat. Tanakama says that edim are not considered to be a kat edim until they witness the event together. Bishua ben Karcha omer afilu bezerachazeh. Bishua ben Karcha says that they don't have to witness it simultaneously. They can witness the event sequentially, or they can get their garner their information sequentially. So that means that they could be a witness to an event or get information from a party, even though they never were there together and they never saw the same event together. This is a new machloket, a second machloket in the Braita, which is that the Tanakhama, the Chachamim over here say that an edut in Beit Din is not a valid edut until both witnesses come to testify together in the Beit Din. Rabbi Natan Omer, Shomim Dvarav Shal Zeh Hayom. One aide can show up today and disclose or testify as to what he saw. And then the other aide can come another day or a day later and come and disclose the information to us. And then we'll be mitzaref. We'll join their two testimonies to make it into a single testimony. So the Gemara supposes over here that our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Natan. Because our Mishnah requires that after the Edim were taken out of the room and discussed with them what they knew, what their testimony was, all that information, we bring them back to be together in the courtroom. Well, why would you bring them back to be together in the courtroom? It's because it seems that we necessitate them testifying together. And that would be like the Tanakhama in the second Machloket in the Braita, that we require that the Edim testify together, and unlike Rabbi Natan, who says they can testify separately. That's why the Gemara says that our Mishnah is the Loka Rabbi Natan. Gemara says, lo, the Olam no Bali Dinim. No, we're speaking about the litigants, and those are the people we have to bring back into the court. Rabbi Nechemia. And it is similar to the position of Rabbi Nechemia. The Tanya, Rabbi Nechemia Omer, Kacha Yaminagam Shal Nikiya Dat Yerushalayim. This was the practice of the righteous and fair-minded people. People who did things properly, with proper etiquette, and did things properly under the halacha. Machnisin the Bali Dinim. They bring in the litigants, Vishomim Divrehem, and they listen to their claims. They bring in the witnesses and they listen to their testimony. And then everybody goes out. And then they deliberate. So that would make sense then if you hold like Rabbi Nechemia that there's nobody there during the deliberations. And then if you're bringing the people back in, it could be equally the litigants like it is the Edim. Because both of them are then sent out of the courtroom so that the judges could deliberate. Don't have a bright gamru at the davar machnisim et ha'edim. Here it's explicit. It doesn't say otan with the pronoun. It says who they brought back in, which is that when they finish the deliberations, they bring the witnesses back in. The Gemara says, "Hi, the local Rabbi Natan." That you're for sure. That you're right about. That right there is clearly not like Rabbi Natan because it requires that the edim come back together to testify together in the court. So now Gufa, the Gemara goes now back to this Braita and discusses the two machlokot that we saw in the Braita. Olam ein edutam mitzterefet ad shiru shnehem keechad. The Tanakhama believes that they have to witness the event simultaneously. Mishua ben Karcha omer afilu bezecha zeh. Mishua ben Karcha says it can even be sequentially. By my kemiflikei, what is the shoresh hamachloket between them? I bayitei makra, vi bayitei masvara. Some say it's derived from a pasuk, and others say it's derived just logically. I bayitei masvara, the logic here is, The Tana Kama believes that you have two witnesses that are testifying over here. One witness says so-and-so owes money. So-and-so either borrowed money or so-and-so admitted that he borrowed the money. Another witness comes along and says so-and-so borrowed money and so-and-so admitted to owing the money. Now, they're both testifying seemingly about the same event and the same money. But the problem is that they testified about it on separate days, that they witnessed it on separate days. If that's the case, then they are talking about very possibly two different events. And that's what the Tana Kama says. We can't put the Eidut together because we have no evidence to corroborate the fact that they're speaking about the same obligation, the same liability, or the same event. And therefore, the one Eid that testifies, he's speaking about something that the other one's not speaking about. And the other Eid, when he testifies about the 100 zuz that's owed, doesn't mean it's the same 100 zuz that the first Eid testified about. Now, there are two primary views within the Rishonim as to how to view this sugya. There's one view amongst the Rishonim, which is championed by the Yad Ramah and the Ramban, which is that this sugya over here is speaking about a case where the Malva actually is making a claim for 200 zuz, or two maneh that he lent to the debtor. And then when the Edim come and testify for us, we believe the Edim, and we put them together because, in a sense, the Malveh's dual claim is supportive of what the witnesses are saying. Either they're testifying about the same event, and therefore they are then corroborating that at least a maneh is owed, or even if they're speaking about two separate events, the Malveh himself says there were two separate events. And therefore, we could say that we could put them together to say there's at least a minimum of 100 zuz over here because they agree or corroborate the statement of the Malveh. On the other hand, if the Malveh only has a single claim over here, then we run into a problem if they deem are testifying what seemingly is about two different events and possibly two different transactions. And in that case, we will not allow them to be mitzaref. On the other hand, there is a view brought by the Meiri that suggests that the situation here in all these cases is where that the claimant or the Malveh is only asking for 100 zuz. And despite the fact that the content or the testimony of these two Edim might be different, nevertheless, we put them together to tell you that at minimum, he is chayav a maneh over here. We don't look at the details of the case. We look at the big picture, which tells us that both Edim are testifying to the fact that he owes 100 zuz. And if we put those together, then we know that we have two Edim saying that he owes 100 zuz. And so therefore, even if the claimant doesn't say he owes 200, only 100, and the Edim seemingly are talking about two different cases, nevertheless, we will put them together in the big picture to obligate the individual to pay the 100 zuz over here. V'idach, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, Amaneh ba'alma tarvayu kamasadeh. They both agree in the end. If you take both of their testimonies, both of their testimonies come to the same conclusion that he owes 100 zuz. He owes a maneh. So it doesn't matter whether it is one event or two events. The conclusion is the same, that he owes 100 zuz. Now, the truth is maybe he owes 200 zuz, but he owes at least a minimum of 100 zuz over here because you have two Edim testifying to the same fact that he owes 100 zuz. And we'll discuss later what might be the shoresh of the machloket between them that gives them this different opinion. And some say it comes out of the psukim, tichtiv, v'hu eid, o ra'ah, o yada. So that's the pasuk that's found in Vayikra Hey with regards to Shvuat Eidut. When someone asks an individual to testify in court, and the individual denies having any knowledge about the case. In Beit Din, they ask him to take a Shvuah to corroborate the fact that he does not know any testimony. He takes a Shvuah, and it turns out that he does know testimony, then he has to bring a Korban Olev V'yoreid for the infraction, the violation of not testifying. And the pasuk begins, Nefesh ki techeta v'shama kol ala v'hu eid o ra'ah o yada. He was a witness, he saw it, or he knows. Im lo yagid, if he does not testify, v'nasa avuno, then he will carry his iniquity, meaning that he'll be held responsible for the fact that he doesn't testify when he really does have information to testify about and denies it under oath. Now the Gemara says, V'tanya, imashma shenemar, the pasuk says, lo yakum ed echad v'ish, that a single aid may not testify against an individual. If it's written in the singular, aid, why do you need to tell me aid echad? Why do you tell me it's a single aid? The word aid by itself would mean a single aid. So ma tamal omer echad. So then why does the pasuk add the qualifier of echad? Zibne av, this is a paradigm that is being set up Anytime the Torah uses the word aid, the definition or default definition of the word aid means two. Until the pasuk specifies otherwise and says one. The fact that the Torah went out of its way to say eid echad, that means that without the word echad, eid would mean two. So eid echad tells you one instead of two. So then, va'afke rachmana b'lashon chad. So then why did the Torah use the singular instead of the plural? If it went two, it should say eidim. Why does it say the word eid if eid really means two? V'meimar ad dechazu tarfayu kechad. Comes to teach you that there has to be a certain unifying force about their testimony. Yes, they are two individuals, but they're two individuals who witnessed the same event at the same time together. And that makes them into a single unit. So we use the word aid to indicate their singularness of their edut, even though they are two individuals. And that is supportive of the Tanakhama's view that they must witness the event together. V'idach, and Rabbi Shimon ben Karcho disagrees, says, V'u'eid o'ra'a o'yoda mikol makom. It says that he witnessed, he saw it, or he knows information mikol makom. It doesn't specify how they came into that information. It doesn't specify that they had the information at the same time. It simply says that they have the information. As long as they both have the information, that information then becomes a singular edut between those two edim, and that's why we use the word aid. So that's the Gzeret HaKatuv, or the reasoning behind the machlok between Rav Shimon ben Karcho and the Tanakhama. Then the second part of the Braita is, Ve'ein edutan mitkayemet bebeitin ad she'idu shneim ke'echad. The Chachamim, in the second part of the Braita, believe that a testimony is only considered to be a single kat edim, or a single unit of edim, if they testify together in Beitin. Rabbi Natan Omer, Shomim Dvarav Shel Zeh Ayom, Shevo Chavir Olamachar Shomim Dvarav. That they can testify completely separately, and then we'll bring them together to make them into a single testimony. Again, here the Gemara asks, what's the shorish hamachloket? What's the root of their disagreement? Some say it's logical, some say it's gzeirat hakatuv. The logical view is, mar savar eid echad ki ati l'shvuati. The Tanakhama, the Chachamim believe that when a single aid shows up, the only thing a single aid can do is force a shvuah on the opposite party. A single aid cannot have any impact in monetary matters. And so, lo namona, lo ati. He's not coming to testify about monetary matters. So then, when the other aid shows up, we can't be mitzdarif them. The first aid, when he came, he didn't come for monetary matters because he's not empowered to do anything with regards to monetary matters. The only thing that he has an impact on is the ability to force a shvuah. So since that's the testimony that he brought and he became an aid as a single aid, and that is for a shvuah, we can't later on then take someone else's testimony and stick it together with him and then say, oh, now you're relevant to Mamon. When you came and testified, you weren't relevant to Mamon. You can't then retroactively make it that your testimony is relevant to Mamon. Therefore, the Chachamim say if they don't testify together, then their edut will not be mitzdareif. Vidach, on the other hand, Rabbi Natan believes, Atu ki ate be'adoya dodi b'chad puma kamasade. Even when they come together to testify, they don't testify simultaneously. They don't really testify exactly at the same time. They, by definition, have to testify sequentially because they can't speak with one mouth. They can't speak at the same time. They have to, by definition, do it sequentially. Ella mitzarfina lahu. But what we do is we say it's sequential and they're counted to be one unit. Achanami mitzarfina, and so to hear. Why does it matter how much of a gap there is between the two testimonies? Since every testimony, by definition, must be sequential, therefore, any sequential testimony should be valid, irrespective of the amount of time between the two testimonies. That's the logic of Rabbi Natan. And the truth is that their machloket might revolve around when an aid becomes an aid. We discussed this in the Gemara Baba Batra, this machloket between the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot, as to whether when you witness an event, does that make you into an aid? Or is it only when you come to court to testify that that actually makes you into an aid? Well, it's not mukhrach. It could be that that's the machloket here between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Natan, as to whether you're already an aid because of your witnessing of the event, and therefore coming to Beit Din is just a formality for you to disclose what you've seen, or does your coming to Beit Din and doing the Haggadah itself, is that what causes or creates you into an aid? And therefore you would have to do it in a manner that creates a single entity of Eidut. So that's a possible way to explain this machloket between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Natan. Vibayitei makra. Some say you can learn it out from the pasuk, because the pasuk says, "Vim lo yagid v'nasa avono." He does not testify to that which he knows, then he will carry the burden of that iniquity. Udukhuli alma, and everybody here holds ki rabbonon. The poligalei Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, like the rabbonon in the first machloket in the Braita, that argue on Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, which is that the witnesses must witness the event simultaneously or together. V'hachi, v'kushi agadah l'riyah kamifligay. The machloket is whether we create a hekesh, a juxtaposition, or a halachic parallel between the testimony and the witnessing. Mar savar, the chachamim, or the Tanakamo believes, makshinan hagadah l'riyah, that we see a connection between testimony in court to the witnessing of the event. Because the beginning of the pasuk says, v'ho'eit o ra'au yada, that is the collection of information. The second part of the pasuk says, im lo yagid v'nasa o'vano, that's about the testimony. Here it's the lack of testimony, that talks about the Haggadah. So we see a juxtaposition between the gathering of information, the witnessing of the event, and the Haggadah, which is the disclosure of that information in court. So the Tanakhama believes, just like by Ri'iyah, we believe that you need them to see it simultaneously, so too when it comes to Haggadah, the disclosure of that information, it must be done simultaneously. Umar Savar, Rabbi Natan believes, lo makshinan, there is no such hekesh, and therefore, yes, by Ri'iyah, they need to witness it simultaneously, but by Haggadah, there's no requirement that it be done simultaneously. Rabbi Shimon ben Eliakim, ala mishtakid alei, the Rabbi Yossi ben Rabbi Chanina, lemismechei. Rabbi Shimon Eliakim was trying hard, making an effort, in order to give smicha to his Talmud, Rabbi Yossi ben Rabbi Chanina. Veloka mistai milta. It just wasn't working out. Again, we saw this, or similar types of ideas early in the Masechta. It usually means they either couldn't gather the requisite three individuals together in order to give the smicha, or the student couldn't be present at the time that the individuals who could give the smicha were ready to give it, or there were other events that were preventing them from doing it. But there was something that wasn't working out, and he couldn't give him smicha. Yom echad avayotiv kamed Rabbi Yochanan. One day they were sitting in front of Rabbi Yochanan learning. Does anybody know whether the halacha is like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha or not? Rabbi Shimon ben Eliakim. So Rabbi Shimon ben Eliakim speaks up, says, "Den yada." He knows. He knows, meaning he's a student. He points to the student, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, and he says, he knows the answer. Amalei, leima ezo. Let him speak up. Let him say what he knows over here. Amalei, lismechei mar. Bereisha. So Rabbi Shimon Eliakim says, to Rabbi Yochanan, give him smicha first. Samche, he gave him smicha. Amalei, bni, amorli, keitzat, shamato. So then after he got smicha, he says to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, okay, tell me what you know now. So Amalei, kach shamati, this is the Mesorah that I have. Shemode Rabbi Shuv ben Karcha, the Rabbi Natan. The Rabbi Shuv ben Karcha agrees to the position of Rabbi Natan. That's not clear from here what that would conclude. Do we conclude then, therefore, since he's trying to imply that the halacha is like Rabbi Natan, because we have a stam mishnah that is supportive of Rabbi Natan's position, and therefore, if Rabbi Shuv ben Karcha holds like Rabbi Natan, it must be that the halacha is like Rabbi Shuv ben Karcha, it's just like the halacha is like Rabbi Natan. Is that what he was trying to say? Or was he trying to say just the opposite? He was saying that Rabbi Shuv ben Karcha holds like Rabbi Natan, but that doesn't mean that Rabbi Natan holds like Rabbi Shuv ben Karcha. So maybe the halacha is like Rabbi Natan, but the halacha is not like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. Those are two possible ways to read what he's saying over here. But what he in essence is saying is that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, who says that they do not have to see the event or witness the event together, he clearly also holds of Rabbi Natan's position, which is that they don't have to testify together. Amar lezeu tzrachti? So Rabbi Yochanan says, that's what I needed this guy for? I needed to give him smicha to get that? Here, where the witnessing of the event, you would assume they have to witness it together. Nevertheless, I'm Rabbi Shimon Karcha, lo ba'ina, and nevertheless, Rabbi Shimon Karcha says, we don't require that you witness it together. Hagodah mi ba'ye? Then when you have to come and testify about what you witnessed, then you would think you need to put it together. Here, Rabbi Shimon Karcha, in what is the essential part of the witnessing, he says you don't have to see it together. Then why would he even think, or why would you even think they have to testify together? It is so obvious that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha holds like Rabbi Natan, and therefore I don't need the information that he's giving me. Nevertheless, Rabbi Yochanan says, since we already gave you smicha, we're not going to put you back down. And since already you are nismach, based on the fact that we thought you had some information that was useful, so therefore we're going to leave you in place. Amar Rabbi Zeira Shmamina, from this you would conclude, Gavar Rabba came into Samich, Samich. that a great person, once the nechah is given, it's given. So over here, there are two ways to read the Gemara. Whether the Gavar Rabba is referencing to Rabbi Yochanan, or is the Gavar Rabba referencing to Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina. And it actually will depend on the girsa that you have here. You can see in the Masada Shas that there's an alternate girsa, which is came to Samich Istamich. Since he got smicha, he got smicha. That girsa would favor saying that the Gavar Rabba here is Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, which is that once a great man like Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina gets smicha, we don't take it back. We don't retract the smicha. So since he was a great Talmud Chacham, and however he got the smicha, it happened, once it's given, we don't retract it. The other way to read it, which is the girsa that we have in our Gemara, would be that once a Gavar Rabba like Rabbi Yochanan is masmich someone, came into samich samich. Once he's given out smicha, it's smicha, and we don't pull it back once he's given it. So the Gavar Rabba would depend on what the girsa you have here is, whether it's samich samich or samich di samich. There is an alternate view here in the Maharshal as to what the point of what Shimon Eliakim was doing over here was that Rabbi Yochanan was looking for someone who would say that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha. The truth is that Rabbi Shimon Karcha is a dat yachid and we wouldn't paskin like him anyway because yachid v'rabim halacha kirabim. But Rabbi Yochanan liked that position of Rabbi Shimon Karcha and he wanted to find somebody who had a misora that would say the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha. What Rabbi Shimon Eliakim says to Rabbi Yochanan is, my Talmud, Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, has a Misora about this, but his Misora will only be valuable if he's a Musmach, if he has Smicha. If he has Smicha, then he gives that Misora, you can rely on that to pass the halacha like Rabbi Shimon Karcha. But if he doesn't have Smicha, then you can't rely on that for the Misora to go against the Rabbim. So he says to him, give him Smicha, and then let him tell you what the Misora is that he has. And he does that. And then Rabbi Yochanan, after hearing that, says that his Misora is not definitive. His Misora doesn't tell us that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha, because his Misora is obvious. The fact that Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha has to hold like Rabbi Natan doesn't prove to you anything about what the halacha is. That Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha has to hold like Rabbi Natan, and it's not information that guides us with regards to the Psak halacha over here. Right? Amar Rabbi Chiya Ba'avin, Amar Rav, halacha ke Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha. That the halacha here is like Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha, ben bekarkot, ben bemetautelin. Doesn't matter if we're talking about property, real property, or we're talking about metaltalin, non-real property. Ulamar halacha k'Rabbi Shimon Karcha b'karkaot avalo b'metaltalin. The halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha by land, but not by movable possessions. Now the difference being, when you have two individuals who testify separately about witnessing an event about a particular object, when you're talking about land, you know that they're talking about the same piece of land, because the land doesn't move. And the land is the same piece of land. In essence, it's just a giloy milta. It's just that they are identifying who the owner of the land is, or they're identifying something about the land. But it's clear that both of them are testifying about the same piece of land, because the land, again, is attached and doesn't go anywhere. Then when you have metaltalin, it's not clear that what one witness is testifying about with regards to one object, that the other witness is testifying about the exact same object. Because by definition, they're metaltalin, they can move, or that they can be exchanged. For that reason, it's not clear that if one witness testifies and then another witness, that we would be mitzareif, that we put them together in order to say that they are a single testimony. So that's the logic behind Ula's position as to why we would differentiate between karkaot and mitaltalin. On the other hand, Rabbi Chiya Ba'avin, in the name of Rav, says that the locha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha across the board. And the reason being that, yes, by karka, it's straightforward, because they're obviously talking about or speaking about the same thing. But by metaltalin, we could surmise from the information that they're giving us that it makes sense that they are speaking about either the same object, or that even if they're speaking about a different object, it generates the same obligation. And that actually might be the machloket between Rabbi Shimon Karcha and the Chachamim as to what we look at when it comes to testimony. Do we look at the individual who's involved here, the debtor, or do you look at the transactions that are involved here? Chachamim say, you look at these transactions, it's two separate transactions, or maybe two separate events, and therefore we can't even start with them. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon Karcha says, you look at the debtor, it's speaking about the same debtor. So irrespective of whether it's two transactions or one transaction, you have two witnesses telling you that this debtor is chayav, he's liable to pay in this case. And so therefore his focus is on the debtor. If you focus on the debtor or the party, then it won't make a difference whether it's karkot or metaltalin. And that's why we would pass an halacha like Rabbi Shimon Karcha in both karkot and metaltalin. Amar le Abaye. So Abaye says back to him, halacha, you're saying halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha, mechlad de plige. makes it sound like the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. V'hama Rabbi Abba, Amar Rabbi Huna, Amar Rav, Moldim Chachamim le Yeshua ben Karcha. The Chachamim agree to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha's position, Be'edut Karcha, when it comes to testimony about real property, about land. V'tani Ravidi Baravin, Benizikin de Beit Karno. And we have an additional bright thought that comes out from the Nezikin de Beit Karno, which here you can see in the Mesorah Shas over here being by the Oruch, and you can see this similarly in the Rabbeinu Chananel, he says the same thing. Perish Nezikin de Beit Karno, Masechta Nezikin, Mishnah Chitzuna Sheyeshuneh Uta Karno, Shem Chacham Yadua, Mufurash Bishnei Dayanei Gzeilot. He's one of the two Dayanim that are mentioned by the Dayanei Gzeilot, which are Karno and Shmuel. And so he was a well-known Dayan with regards to Dinei Mimononot, and he has his own book of Braitot that he utilized in order to understand Mishnayot or understand the Gemarot. So over here we're bringing one of those Braitot. Modim Chachamim Yerushu Ben Karcha Beidut Bechor Ubeidut Karko Ubeidut Chazaka V'chein Shebeben V'shem Bebat. So here you have an admission of the Chachamim to Yerushu Ben Karcha's position in a number of situations. The one that's most important to us is Be'edut Karka, that the Chachamim agree with regards to Karka, that the separate witnessing of an event is still valid. And again, that's for the same reason that we said before, that by Karka, the land itself is stationary or static, and therefore the witnessing of something about that property, by definition, we should be able to mitzdarif them and not think that they're speaking about two different events or two different pieces of property. With regards to Edut Chazaka, there you can have two witnesses. One witness says that the guy lived there for the first 3 years, and another witness that says he lived there for the subsequent 3 years. So even though they're not testifying about the same 3 years, but if you join their testimony together, you have two witnesses saying that he lived there for 3 years, he was on the property for 3 years, and that will establish the chazakah. The case of Edut Bechor, Rashi and the Balei Tosafot argue about what that is. Rashi over here says that it is not that a chacham was matir a bechor. In their day, a bechor that was born had to be brought to the mikdash and put on the mizbeach, and was given to the kohen in order to do that. It's a property of the kohen, and the kohen brings it up to the mikdash and eats it in Yerushalayim as a kurban bechor. If the bechor gets a mum in it, it gets a blemish in it, which would disqualify it from going on the mizbeach, then the kohen is entitled to eat it as chulin with some restrictions at home in his house. So, Kohanim, in general, had a vested interest in a Bechor getting a mum in it, because then they could eat it as chulin at home, instead of having to take it up to the Mikdash to put on the Mizbeach and eat it. So now, if they get a psak from a Chacham that says that the mum that is in this Bechor disqualifies it from going on the Mizbeach, and you want someone to verify that information, that's what Edut Bechor is. That Edut Bechor means that we have two witnesses telling us that the Chacham was matir, this animal. Rashi rejects that explanation because he says you don't need two witnesses for that. That is what we call Eidechan Ne'eman Bisurim. This is an issue of Isur. The Chacham Paskin, you need a single aid to give you that information. You don't need two Eidim to give you that information. And that's why that cannot be what we're speaking about here. But rather, what we're speaking about here is that a Kohen needs to bring evidence to the Chacham that the mum that came into this animal happened passively and not actively. The Kohanim, or especially a Ro'eh Kohen, a Kohen who is a shepherd, is chashud. He's suspected of intentionally placing mumim in the Bechor in order to ease the situation for himself. And therefore, if he brings a mum before a chacham to paskin about whether this disqualifies it from going to Mizbeach, he has to also bring evidence to the fact that it happened passively. And he needs witnesses to the fact that this mum happened by itself. And that's what Rashi says, the Edut Bechor that we're speaking about here, is that you need two witnesses to that fact. The Balei Tosafot reject Rashi for the exact same reason he rejects the other explanation, which is, Balei Tosafot would say you don't need two witnesses to tell you that the mum happened passively. Again, it's Eidechan Ne'eman Bisurim. You just need another aid besides the Kohen himself, who is not believed because he's suspected of doing it intentionally. You just need one aid to tell you that the mum happened passively. And therefore, the Balei Tosafot also reject Rashi's explanation and say that's not Edut Bechor, but rather Perish. Shishamu mi'aviv zechar zeh ish ploni ben bechor hu. So he says it's not speaking about a bechor of an animal, it's speaking about a bechor adam. And the father identifies one of his children as the bechor. And the witnesses heard it separately from him. One witness had heard it from the father saying that this child is the bechor now. And then subsequent to that, another aide heard from the father that he says that this child is the bechor. so that we can be mitzarif into a single testimony about this individual that he is a bechor. And that's what the Beit Tosfot would say the Eidur HaBechor is. But nevertheless, you have now here a number of places where the Chachamim agree to Rabbi Shua ben Karcha. And that is a Bayi's question over here as to why you passing aloha like Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, implying that the Chachamim disagree. The Chachamim actually agree in this case of Eidur Karcha, where it says, Gavra, Gavra, Karamit, my summer pligi, my summer lo pligi. Wait a minute, you're asking from one person on another person? You're talking about here two different positions within the Amoraim. You can't ask from one Amora's position on another Amora's position. Ula says the Allah is Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, and he believes that the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Shua ben Karcha. Rabbi Abba, Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav, and the Braita of Karna believe that they don't disagree, or that the Chachamim agree to Rabbi Shua ben Karcha with regards to Eidur Karcha, and therefore he thinks that you don't have to say Allah ke Rabbi Shua ben Karcha. The Allah is also like the Chachamim, because everybody agrees in that case that you can't be mitzarif the witnessing of the events. And that might be why the Gemara brought down the Braita of Karna, was to reinforce that over here we're not talking about a mainstream Braita that is well accepted. We're talking about some unique Braita that was Karna's Braita. And that means that it's a Dat Yachid over there. And therefore you can't say Ula is bound by that Braita that Karna brought. Because that's not a mainstream Braita. And therefore, Ula have one position, and Karna will have a different position. So it actually turned out that you have actually now here three different positions in the name of Rav. You have Rabbi Abba Amar Huna Amar Rav, who says that the Chachamim agreed to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha be'edut Karka. And that was the last position that we saw over here. Rabbi Abba Amar Rav Huna, that was corroborated by the Braita of Karna. You have Rabbi Chia Ba'avin Amar Rav, who says that Allah is like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha ben be'karkaot ben be'metautalim. Irrespective of what the item is, that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha, whether it's real property or non-real property. And then you have Rabbi Zeira Mishmei the Rav, which is the position of Rabbi Zeira that which we'll see later on, and is consistent with the position of Ula that we have over here, that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Karcha b'karka alt, avalo b'metautalin. It's like him in Karcha, not b'metautalin, differentiated from the other position of Rav Huna Marav, who say that the Chachamim agree in the case of Karcha. Over here, Rabbi Zeira says the Chachamim still disagree, but he thinks the halacha is only like Rabbi Shimon Karcha with regards to karkaot. So it turns out you actually have three different positions here being quoted in the name of Rav. Now, my v'chein shebeben shebebat, I explained all the items in the Braita as to what the testimony is about there that can be mitzareif, except for the last two, which is the ben and the bat. Ilem ha'achad omer achat b'gaba ve'achad omer achat b'kreisa. So the Gemara now automatically jumps and says, you know what, we know what they're talking about. We're talking about whether a child has come of age. Did this boy reach puberty or did this girl reach puberty? So now we have witnesses to that event. So Elam, if you say that the way that you have two witnesses here is, one says that there is a single pubic hair on her back, and one says it's on the front. Hai chatzi davar v'chatzi edutu. There the disqualification is not simply that they are testifying separately about the same event or the same item. Over there, they're not even testifying about the same item. One of them is testifying about a pubic hair in the back. One is testifying about a pubic hair in the front. So not only do you have a chatzi edut, you have a chatzi davar. They don't even have two pubic hairs together that they're testifying about. As Rashi notes over here, that eid achad hu chatzi edut, one eid is half an edut, and then one hair is chatzi davar. So here, you not only have chatzi edut, which you're trying to be mitzareif, like Rabbi Shimon Karcha, but you also have a chatzi davar, which is that you only have one hair instead of the requisite two hairs that will you need to declare someone of age. Ella, echad omer shtayim b'gabav, echad omer shtayim b'kreisa. No, the case is where one aid testifies to two pubic hairs in the back, and one testifies to two pubic hairs in the front. So both of them are saying that this individual has reached the age of puberty. It's just that they are saying it or witnessing it through different evidence. One seeing the evidence in the back, and one seeing the evidence in the front. But they're both witnessing the same conclusion, which is that this child has reached the age of puberty. So that's the case that we're speaking about there, where the Chachamim would agree to Rabbi Shua ben Karcha that we would be mitzareif the edut. I'm Rav Yosef. Ana amina mishmei du ula. I say over in the name of Ula, Alocha Rabbi Shua ben Karcha ben bekarkot ben bemitautalim. Irrespective of what it is, the Alocha is like Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, both by Karkot and by Metautalim, as opposed to what we saw before from Ula, where we said the Loch is like him by Karkot, but not by Metautalim. Rav Yosef had the Mesorah that Ula said it by both. The Rabbanon, the Atom and Mechuzah, on the other hand, the Rabbanon that come from Mechuzah, Amrei, Amar Abzeira, Mishmeid, the Rav, the Karkaot in, Avalo Ben Tautalin. And they say that Rabbi Zera says in the name of Rav, Alocha is like Rabbi Shuman Karcha by Karkaot, but not by Metautalin. So Rav Yosef says that Ula's position is that Alocha is like Rabbi Shuman Karcha, Ben Karkaot, Ben Metautalin, similar to what we quoted in the name of Rabbi Chir Ba'avin before. And the Rabbanon from Mechuzah say that Rabbi Zera's position, the name of Rav, is that it's Karkaot in of Alo Ben Metautalin, which would be similar to the position of Ula that we brought before, that Rabbi Yosef is saying is not the position of Ula, because he thinks Ula thinks that the loch is like Mishum and Karcha, Ben Bekarkold, Ben Mimitalkalin. So Gemara says, Rav the Tameh, this is Rav the Shittato, Dama Rav, Hoda'a Achar Hoda'a, Hoda'a Achar Halva'a Mitztarfe. If we have one aid testifying about the fact that the debtor admitted to owing the money, and another aid testifying about a separate incident where the admitted to the fact that he owed the money to the creditor, or you have a witness saying that the debtor admitted to the fact that he owed the money, after we have a witness that witnessed the debtor borrowing the money from the creditor, those two witnesses are mitztarif. Halva'a achar halva'a, or halva'a achar hoda'a, lo mitztarfe. On the other hand, if they both witnessed the lending of the money separately, or one of them heard about an admission by the debtor that he owed the money, and then subsequent to that, an individual witnessed the lending of the money, lo mitztarfe. Over there, they are not mitztarif. That is because in the latter two cases, it's clear that they're speaking about two events. Because the fact that he admitted to owing the money before they witnessed the transaction, it's clear there that that admission is talking about a different event than the transaction that happened subsequent to that. Or if they both witness transactions, and the transactions are in different days or at different times, it's clear that we're not speaking about the same transaction, we're speaking about different transactions. So in that case, they are not mitztareif. On the other hand, if you have a case where there's both of them testifying about an admission, or one testified about a transaction, and subsequent to that, they had testimony about an admission, over there, they could be speaking about the same event, and therefore they are mitztareif. So that's why it is rav l'tameh, because events where we know it's the same object, then we will say that the halacha is like Rabbi Shuman Karcha. So that's true by Karcha. And that's true by certain events by mitaltalin or by maneh. But in a case where the maneh is a different maneh, or it's clear that the mitaltalin are different, we won't allow them to be mitztareif. And that's the difference between karka and mitaltalin, where we say karka is mitztareif and mitaltalin are not mitztareif. And that is now corroborated by Rav's position with regards to hoda'ah and halva'ah. Because in both of those cases, you can assume that they're speaking about the same event. But in a case where it's impossible that they're speaking about the same event, over there Rav says they're not mitztareif. And similarly, by Karkaot, they're mitztareif, because they're clearly speaking about the same object and the same event. Whereas by Metalkalin, where it's not clear that they're speaking about the same object or event, there they won't be mitztareif, because he requires it to be about the same maneh, or same object, not just that the debtor owes the money. Unless it's obvious or clear that they must be, or could be, speaking about the same event or the same item, which would make it similar to Karkaot. So Ashkei Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, the Rav Huna Brei the Rav Yeshua, Amalei, Maishna Halva'a Achar Halva'a Dolo. Why is it that when you have one witness about a transaction and another witness about a transaction, I mean the borrowing of money, it's clear there, the Manat Kachazi Hai, Lo Kachazi Hai, the money lent by one was not seen as the same money lent by the other, because witness A saw it on Sunday and witness B saw it on Monday, and they're two separate transactions. Hoda Achar Hoda Nami. You could say the same thing with regards to the debtor's admission that he owes money to the creditor. Hundred zuz that he's admitting to in front of this witness is not necessarily the same 100 zuz that he's admitting to in front of the other witness. Damalei, the high batra, bahai maned odiale kamech, odiale nami kamei ploni. Because when he goes to the second one to admit that he owes the money, he says, this admission that I'm making to you, that I owe the money to the creditor, I already admitted in front of so-and-so that I owe that money to the creditor. It says, Akate Batra, Yoda Kamalo Yoda. So okay, the latter witness knows about the information about the other witness, but that doesn't mean the first witness knows about the second witness. It says, the Hadar Azil, Amarle, the Kamot, the debtor goes back to the original witness and says to the first witness, Haimanad Odile Kamech, Odile Nami Kamech Ploni. The maneh that I admitted to in front of you, I now also admitted to it in front of so-and-so. Amarlei, so he says to him, Tanuach datcha, shehitnachto edati. You should be at ease because you put me at ease. I didn't understand this distinction of Rav, and now you explain to me why there's a difference in the cases in Rav's position. Amalei, my nichuta. He says, why are you so at ease now? Why do you think this is a good answer? So it's very interesting. So Rav Nachman Mayitzah, Rav Huna Debrei Rav Shua, and then he asked him the question, and then Rav Huna Debrei Rav Shua gives him an answer. Then after Rav Nachman Mayitzah compliments him on the answer, Rav Huna Debrei Rav Shua says, why is it such a good answer? The Rav of Itam Rav Sheshit Shadabanargo. Because Rav or Rav Sheshit threw an X into it. I mean, they broke it up. They said that the answer is not a good answer. Lav hainu hodah achar halva'a. How is this then distinguished from hodah achar halva'a? If you explain to me that hodah achar hodah means that the debtor basically discloses the information to both parties. He discloses it to the second witness that I already admitted to this in front of the first witness. And after the second witness, he goes back to the first witness and then discloses that information that which I admitted to you, I also now admitted to in front of another witness. So now, if that's the way that it works to have them be mitzareif, in the case where you have a case of hoda'a achar halva'a, an admission after one other witness witnessed the transaction, you're going to have to say the same thing there, that both witnesses were informed about the other witness's information. Once you do that, then what's the differentiation between the two cases? Both cases are the exact same thing. All the information was disclosed to both witnesses, and that's why they're able to be mitzareif. Why do you have to give me two cases of that? One case would suffice of that. And therefore, it's problematic. So that's what Rav Nachman Yitzchak says to Rav Huna Brid Rav Shua, Hainu Deshmiel Li Alaychu. That's what I hear about you guys. Deramitu Dikle Viskefitu Lehu. That you guys uproot palm trees, and then you replant them somewhere else. Meaning that you guys do these things that seem worthless. You're breaking down, building, breaking down, and you're not getting anywhere. So it's all over here. You guys gave this beautiful answer, and then you undermined that beautiful answer. Nadei Amre, the Nadei say, Ben Hoda'a Achar Hoda'a, Ben Hoda'a Achar Hova'a, whether it's an admission after admission, or it's an admission after a transaction, Ben Hova'a Achar Hova'a, whether it's a transaction after another transaction, Ben Hova'a Achar Hoda'a, whether it's a transaction after admission, mitzarfot. They all can be joined together to become now a single testimony to obligate the party. Come on. Who is that like? Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha. Obviously, they're holding Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha that witnesses can witness separate events and then be mitzareif together to become a single kat edim. I'm a Rav Yehuda. Eidut ha-machashet zo et zo. If you have two witnesses that come along and they are inconsistent in their testimony, bibig dikot, with the extra checks that we do about the edim, in monetary matters, that does not disqualify them, or it still allows them to be a single kat edim. Amarova, mistavra milte de Rav Yehuda, bechadomer ba'arnaki shchora, bechadomer ba'arnaki levana. Makes sense what he's saying. If one says that the money that was borrowed came out of a white wallet, or a white pouch, and the other one says it came out of a black pouch or a black wallet. Aval echadomer maneh shachor, one of them says that the 100 zuz were black. Bechadomer manet lavan, and the other one says that the 100 zuz were white, then ain't mitzarfin. There's no way they can be mitzarfin there because that's integral to the case. The money that was borrowed is an integral piece of information to the case. And if you're missing that information, then you can't have them say something that's inconsistent and still say that they're a single edut. Now, what it means that the money is white or black, Rashi over here says that these are old coins or new coins. Others suggest that white means silver, and black means copper or maybe some other metal. So that, and they disagree on that point, then it's clear that they're inconsistent and they can't be joined together to create a single edut. But it says, "V'arnaki shchura b'dinei nefashot lo." The implications of the statement of Rava are that this only works by dinei memonot. By dinei nefashot, it wouldn't work. And he suggests over here, by dinei memonot, if you had difference in the colors of the wallets, that would not disqualify the edim, implying that by dinin nefashot that would disqualify the edim. V'hama Rav Chista, didn't Rav Chista say, Echad omer b'saif, harago, one of them says that the murder weapon was a sword, Echad omer b'ariran, harago, and the other one says that it was either a dagger, or a scalpel, or an axe, some other murder weapon, that's what he killed him with, ein zenachon. Those are not consistent edut, and therefore they will be disqualified because this is an essential part of the edut, the murder weapon. And so they do not qualify to say, v'hinei emet nachon davar, that what they're saying is consistent and proper. Echad omer kelav shchorim, v'echad omer kelav levanim. On the other hand, if one of them says he was wearing black, and the other one says he was wearing white, harizeh nachon. That's still considered to be a consistent testimony, despite the inconsistency in their testimony, because it's not something that's integral to the case, and therefore it does not undermine the testimony of the two witnesses. Gemara here again says, Gavra, Gavra Karamit? Why are you asking a question from one Amora to another Amora? That is the view of Rav Chista, and Rav Yehuda doesn't necessarily agree with that. Rava is qualifying Rav Yehuda's position. He's explaining Rav Yehuda's position. Rav Yehuda believes that this is true by Dine Memonot. It's not true by Dine Fashot. Rav Chista says, even by Dine Fashot, if the wall is a different color, then it's still okay, the testimony. Just like if the clothing of the individual is different, it'd be fine by Dine Fashot. But that's Rav Chista's position. Rava, who's explaining Rav Yehuda, thinks that Rav Yehuda's position is differentiated from Rav Chista, and they're not necessarily consistent. Whenever you can't ask a stira from one Amora to another Amora, they have different positions, and they're going to argue about their positions. Okay, we're going to stop here by the top line on Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph.